let yourself just simply, objectively appreciate the world of your experience with a kind of curiosity and wonder. That would include all of the sounds outside and the sense of touch, the air, the coolness of the air, the sensations of your physical body. Just look at them as experiences that you're having. Whatever thoughts or feelings are taking place in the mind, just have an objective interest and curiosity. A compassionate or loving curiosity, a wonderment. Notice your breath. Just the totality of your experience. Let yourself simply relax and be with the experiences as part of Ishvara, belonging to Ishvara. Absolutely all of them, all of the perceptions, the physical body, the breath, the thoughts, feelings, good and bad, positive and negative. Relax and allow them just to simply be as they are. And let yourself simply recognize that fact, that these experiences exist. These emotions exist. These sensations exist. as you allow yourself to relax, just enjoy your own presence. The one who is present to all of this changing phenomena. Myself, the conscious being that is present, no matter which perception or sensation or emotion is presenting itself, it's always presenting itself to me. It doesn't cover me, it doesn't change me. I am the stable one that all of these different experiences shine after. Thoughts are known because I am there. Emotions are known because I am there. Perceptions are known because I am there. All of them shine after me. Experience is dependent on me for its knownness, for its being known. But I am not dependent on them. The awareful being, the conscious being that I am, is self-evident awareness. There is no other consciousness lighting me up. I am the self-evident conscious being. Because of which all things appear as known. I give my being and consciousness to all experiences. Those experiences coming and going. Don't phase me. Change me. To me. Nor do I depend on them in any way. They depend on me. I don't depend on them. let yourself relax. And enjoy these manifestations. Of knowledge, manifestations of experience. Manifestations of Ishwar. Recognizing the changeless pervasiveness of my being. To all of these manifestations of knowledge. Om Bhadram Karne Bish Om Bhadram Karne Bish Shrinuyama Devaha Shrinuyama Devaha Bhadram Pashe Makshabirya Chitraha Bhadram Pashe Makshabirya Chitraha Stirai Rangai Istishtuvagum Sastanubihi Stirai rangai istushtu vagun sastanubihi Yashema devahitan yadayuhu Yashema devahitan yadayuhu Swastina indro vrittashravaha Swastina indro vrittashravaha Swastina pusha vishwavedaha Swastina Pusha Vishwavedaha Swastina Starksho Arishtanemihi Swastina Starksho Arishtanemihi Swastino Brahaspatir Tathatu Swastino Brahaspatir Tathatu Om Shanti Shanti Shantihi Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. We're starting a new section. It's the first verse in the second section now. In the first section, in the first few verses, Shaunaka presented, Angira presented, two knowledges, Paravidya and Avaravidya. Paravidya is Brahmajnanam, Atmajnanam. The Avaravidya, the lower vidya, is everything, all secular knowledge and also all Vedic knowledge. All of the Vedas are included in that, Apra or Avaravidya. All of the, even all of the astrology and studying of grammar, studying chanting, every single, all knowledge, everything that has to do with what's going on within the world, all learning, everything that exists within duality falls under this Apara or Avaravidya. So now, in the first section, initially what was presented, these two knowledges, then the Rig Veda, Yajur Veda, Sama Veda, all of these were dismissed. And then the Aparavidya, the Paravidya, was revealed. Right? And that's what these last few verses have been, so beautifully giving the vision of Ishwar and of myself as the whole. Now, in this section, the Adhikari is really being extolled and presented. And it's being, the Adhikari is being presented by first talking again about this Aparavidya, or the lower knowledge, the knowledge that takes place, the knowledge where the knowledge of the karmas and the karmapalas, right, the actions and the fruits of our actions that take place within the creation. And so before we really understand what is jnanam, or why a person would become an adhikari for atma-jnanam, for self-knowledge, the teacher wants to present exactly what is the knowledge or the karmapala, the fruits of one's actions, that are gained through the Vedas, through the first part of the Vedas. And so that's what's being talked about here. Because if you look at the entire Vedas, which are really the scriptures of India, that really that delineate all that there is to do, how to do it, what there is to do, what are the purusharthas, what are the main goals of a human being, how to become a whole and full human being. The Vedas deal with that, how to live a dharmic life, all of these type of things. How to fulfill my desires. Right? Initially, a person will be dependent on the first part of the Vedas that we call the Karmakanda to know how to live a dharmic life, because the first part of the Vedas and all of the Puranas, everything, the Mahabharata, everything will really deal with that. How to live a dharmic life, and what are the rituals that I need to do, what are the rituals that must be done, that are enjoined upon me to be done, and what are the rituals that I need to do so that I can attain certain lokas, certain worlds of experience, or certain worldly desires here in this world? The Vedas give innumerable rituals that need to be done in order to fulfill my duties as a human being, to live a dharmic life, and many, many rituals that need to be done or can be done in order to achieve happiness in another life or in later births, or to go to higher lokas, better lokas, so that I can get more enjoyment, or to even go to what we call Swargaloka or Brahmaloka, which is a heaven world. There are rituals that are enjoined upon a karmi, you know, to do if they want to achieve these types of experiences of ananda, right? Experiences of happiness. Like even if I were there, they're what we call rituals just to fulfill ordinary kamas, ordinary desires. I could do a ritual. Say if I felt, say I was married and I wanted so badly to have children, but year after year we would try to have children. It's not able to have children. Now, so many couples actually really suffer very, very deeply over this. And so there's a ritual called Putra Kameshti. It's a ritual. When there's a desire to have a child, right? So there's a ritual for that. And so I can do these rituals to evoke a certain grace, you know, or what we call adrishtapala, unseen, you know, results that are unseen. We don't understand how the doing of that particular ritual would ever bring about a child, you know. But this putra kameshti, if it's done properly, if it's done perfectly, then that can result in, you know, the birth of a child. There are other types of rituals just for kamas, for desires. Like if in the city, or in a township, there are no rains, there's a drought. Everybody's suffering because there's no rain. There's rituals that can be done to evoke the rain. The ritual has to be done correctly. Then for an individual, there are certain rituals that need to be done that are enjoined upon you as a householder, for instance. There's a ritual called the Agnihotra ritual, which these are dealing with the Agnihotra ritual. It's a fire ritual that's to be done by you twice a day, by the man, in the morning and the evening. It's blessed by the wife. She provides the materials for it and the naivedyam and various things that are needed for that particular puja, but she has to be there to bless that puja, and then that ritual, and it takes place twice a day. And that's enjoined on Brahmana and other people to do. And that those rituals, if done properly, will produce some punya that will help you to go to a better loka. And then that Agnihotra, for somebody who's doing the Agnihotra ritual, which is kind of the basic ritual, there are other rituals on top of that that we'll see that can help you to get to even a higher loka. There are 7 lokas up. To get to even a higher loka, a better loka. And by a higher loka or better loka, it means one where there is less dukkha. There is more sukha, more joy, more happiness, more harmony. You know, and so you can work to gain those experiences. They're called karmapalas. They're called lokas. These lokas, these worlds, are actually karmapalas. So you can be working, doing your rituals and doing all of these things properly in order to gain these results so that you can get a better experience, a higher experience, more ananda, more bliss. But the problem is this, that all of these gains, all of these karmapalas that are gained by the doing of these rituals, which we'll see in some detail how they're done, the doing of these rituals, all of them are as finite as the ritual. In other words, a ritual which is done will produce, just like, let me put it this way, any karma that is done will produce a result. Any action, it may not produce the result that you want because you didn't do the karma quite properly. And I'm talking about any action that you do, even in this world, any action that you do, it will produce a result. It may or not be the result that you want. You may have not done the action properly, or there may have been a lot of unseen forces that have come and gotten in the way, but the action will produce a result. But the action that is producing the result is limited by nature. It's not there's no such thing as an infinite action to produce an infinite result. So the finite action will definitely produce a finite result. This is just in Vyavahara, just in the world. But this is also true for karmas, a ritual. A ritual, if perfectly done, will produce the result that it promises to produce. If it's not done according to viddhi, according to the rules, or not at the right time, or certain things are done improperly, then it won't produce any result. As you'll see, at Shankara says the only result that it will produce then is the effort and the smoke in your eyes. The smoke in your eyes in the effort and all of the, you know, the gathering of the wood and all of the work, that's the result. It's just what we call the drishtapala. You know, the exact, one of the results would be, well, you started a fire. Another result is that you burnt a lot of ghee in the fire. That's a result, right? That's drishta. Another result is it was smoked and the smoke got in your eyes and your eyes watered. So there's a lot of what we call ayasa. There's a lot of effort involved in the doing of a ritual. So if you do the ritual improperly, then there will be the drishta pala there, the immediate result, right, of doing it, which would be you get the fire and you build the bricks and everything that's there. That does happen. But the adrishta, the punya, you know, that unforeseen, unseen result that we call adrishta, which literally means unseen, that doesn't happen because it wasn't performed properly. Right? That's not that different from here. Then, you know, just in Jivahara, just in the world, the action has to be done properly to produce the result. Here, we do not know how it is that these actions would even produce a result. How is it that we would know that laying the bricks in a particular way, lighting the fire so that it flamed in a particular way, and throwing the ghee in at a particular time on a particular side of the fire, chanting a particular mantra, that this ritual would deliver a son? How on earth would we know that? And so here at this in this section, it starts out saying these rituals are true. These rituals are satyam. And what they mean is, this is what we're going to tell you. These rituals are satyam. Means that satyam means they do produce a result. Satyam means that it's true. The act produces a result. They do produce the result. What are these mantras? These rituals? They are the rituals that are seen by the rishis in the mantras. And these rituals that are seen by the rishis in the mantras, they do produce satyam. Means there is a cause and effect. By satyam here, they mean the result of the karma. They do produce these. You know? And so then it goes on to give us a little bit of knowledge, just laying out kind of the terrain of the karmakanda and these rituals that can be done to really take you as far as Brahmaloka, a heavenly world. But then, what is it that you are actually going to achieve? Can you achieve something that is not finite? So in order to understand what is the difference between the Karmakanda, this first part of the first part of the Vedas, which teaches you about how to live and how to live a dharmic life so that you can have some sort of peace of mind, how to fulfill your desires, how to do rituals to fulfill your desires so that you can gain something that will make you happy. If I have a child, I will be happy. Right? If it rains, I will be happy. If I go to Swargaloka, I will be happy. So it tells you the rituals that can be done to give you situational happiness, even relatively long-term situational happiness. Like if you were to go to a heaven world that lasts for a really long time, you have a really long time of situational happiness. Yeah. It's still relative, but it's better than here. It doesn't have the extreme dukkha. You get to kind of, you know, you get to whatever you want to enjoy, that will manifest for you. There's not all of the obstacles, and so the mind, when the mind doesn't have a lot of obstacles to your presenting itself to you, then the mind enjoys a natural just state of relaxation. And in a state of relaxation, whether you're here in this world or you're in heaven, or you're in a dream, or anywhere, wherever you are, if the mind enjoys a certain state of calm and relaxation, that mind reflects the ananda of the self in such a way that it reflects the self in such a way that it has the experience of happiness. And so, say in Swarga Loka, the situation is such that the mind is just always, you know, fine, because nothing gets in your way. In this world, as soon as you fulfill a desire, something comes and messes it up. You know, so you get this little moment of happiness, but then something comes and messes up the waters. And so this happiness that you receive from the fulfilling of a desire is not allowed to last very long. And so you get sukha dukkha, sukha dukkha, sukha dukkha, sukha dukkha. You get that little moment of sukha and dukkha comes right in. You know, because the world just, you know, crushes that ideal situation, that ideal moment, continually crushed. In Swarga Loka, the ideal moment isn't crushed. So you're just, wow, this is nice. Because nothing causes your mind to tense up. The world doesn't cause your mind to tense up. In reality, the ananda, the wholeness of the self, is the same for the participant in Swarga Loka and the participant here and the participant in hell, hell world. The ananda of the self is exactly the same. But what's going on in the mind? Here, in what we call Bhuloka, in this particular loka, it's 50-50. Situationally, your karmas are such that the universe will throw out 50% positive situations, which means allows your mind to relax. You look out in the world, oh, this is just how I want it to be. Isn't this wonderful? Your mind relaxes. You feel, you experience ananda. Then 50, and within that experience of ananda, of course, there's a range, but it's on the ananda side of things. So situationally, it's kind of okay, and my mind is kind of relaxed. To, wow, this is fantastic, and my mind is really relaxed. And so I'm kind of happy to, whoa, this is, couldn't ask for more. To just the middle ground, to the other 50% of, this is not very good. To where I feel a little darkness in there, to, this is downright hell, how could this happen? Where I'm in agony, right? So that's not the self. The self isn't shooting off into ananda or shooting off into agony, but the world is presenting events which, if you are only dependent upon the world for your happiness, what the world does will make me happy or sad, then you will get 50-50. 50% of the experiences will be on the positive side approximately, and 50% will be on the negative side. If, for you, the only criterion for your ananda is what the world is doing, right? You reap the experience of happiness from the world. For a person who follows more dharma, where my experience of happiness then is a little bit removed from what the world is giving me, because I've learned I have more of a value for how I respond to the world than what the world is doing. So I become a little bit more removed. I then, even relatively, if the world is giving me a negative situation, I may not experience it as inside with the same pain as somebody who was totally just bouncing off of what the world was doing. So that's how I learn. One becomes more attached to dharma or to your own value systems, because you gain a distance. What is your highest, what you hold in highest regard is more dharma or what is appropriate action, because it gives me a deeper peace. So I'm a little bit removed then from the pains of the world. And for a jnani, it's much, much different. It's much different. Because for a jnani, somebody who has self-knowledge, that mind is not depending on the world as my source of ananda. It's not even depending on dharma as my source of ananda. It depends on the self as the source of ananda. And dharma is something that is natural to a person, to a human being. Dharma is natural to a human being who isn't being pulled into a dharma by your desire to have this thing. You know, I have to have this thing. And I'm sorry if I have to be a dharmic. I can't help it. I need this. And I can't help myself. If you don't need this, then you can help yourself. You know. So that's kind of how it goes. A person who has knowledge, their mind, their main attachment is for Ananda, is the self, and then they can enjoy Ishvara. For a dharmi, the main attachment is to dharma. And then they have more of an equipoise because they're more attached to the peacefulness of mind that's brought about by dharmic behavior in a situation than they are about the situation itself. Where a real samsari, what we call a bogi, somebody who is just oriented toward experience, they're not really held by dharma. They're not really held by the self. They're held by what the world is offering. And then the waves are very tumultuous. The waves of this ocean of samsara, which is often what is used as the example, the waves of the ocean of samsara are terribly tumultuous. Now, say, from Vedic life, as somebody who's held by the Vedas, and you're not a jnani, you take this world to be very real, and you yourself view maybe the highest thing that you can gain in this world is Swargaloka, is heaven. That is the ultimate. Because in Swargaloka, I won't be bound by the ups and downs of experience like that. And so, by doing these rituals properly and living a life of dharma and doing the rituals properly and doing what's expected of me, I can attain this Swargaloka. And that will be my moksha. That's what I consider karmakandi, one who's of this first portion of the verse. That's what I consider, right, as freedom or liberation. That's as far as I can go. That's the ultimate for me. And that's what I work for. So people who have not yet become adhikaris, they are still contained within the creation, but they're being held by the Vedas. So they follow dharma, because the Vedas also teaches you dharma and what is a proper behavior, your stages of life, and all of the different the caste that you're born into, the stage of life that you're in, your duties toward your parents, your duties toward your partner, your duties toward your children. There's a whole system that holds you. And daily there are offerings to the Lord. Daily there are rituals to be done, particularly the Agnihotra. Rituals to be done where you're recognizing the gods, you're recognizing the Lord. And you also are doing these in order to reap the fruits of those rituals so that you can get a better birth next time and perhaps go enjoy, in between births, enjoy a better loka and maybe even go to heaven. So that is what is holding you. And in your mind, you will think, the ultimate for me is getting to the Swargaloka. Okay? So that's what these verses are talking about. So let's take a look through that little introduction. So starting with the verse 1, Kade Tet Satyam.
Oh, I'm sorry. Do you have an extra book? Yeah. Page 106.
Okay. So repeat after me. Tere tat satyam. Mantreshu karmani. Kavayaha. Tere tat satyam. Mantreshu karmani. Kavayaha. Yanya pashyan sthani. Tretayam Bahudasan Tatani. Tretayam Bahudasan Tatani. Tanya Charita. Tanya Charita Niyatam. Satya Kamaha. Eshavaha. Pantaha. Sukritasya Loke. Guru says, Tere Tat Satyam. That which I'm going to say is true. He's going to be talking about karmas now. This is true, what is going to be said. Tere Tat Satyam. Sunday. Tat Etat Satyam. Mantreshu Karmani Kavayaha Yani Apashyan Tani Tretayam Bahuda Santatani Tani Acharata Niyatam Satyakamaha Eshaha Vaha Pantaha Sukratasya Loke. He says that which I'm going to be saying now, that this is true. Literally it just says that this true. Okay. Tat etat satyam. The idea is that now what I have to say, that is satyam. And exactly what they mean by satyam is say. Mantreshu, in the mantras. The mantras are the verses, the Vedic the little Vedic verses, we call them mantras. In the mantras, karmani, the karmas, the rituals. Karmas mean rituals. So in the mantras, the karmas, kavyaha, nominative plural from kavi, the kavis, the rishis. Kavi means the rishis, the ones who see clearly are the kavis. The kavis, yani, which, apashyan, see. Apashyan, past tense, saw. It says, the mantras, the rituals, which the kavis, which the rishis saw in the mantras. Tat, those karmas are satyam. Those things, it's like this, those things, the karmas now we're talking about, which the rishis saw in the mantras, because the mantras appeared to the rishis, those are true. Those are true. Now, it's what it's saying. The karmas are true. When you say that the karmas are true, the rituals are true, what does that mean? It means that the ritual that is revealed in the mantra produces the result, the karma pala that the ritual says it produces. So when you say the karma has satyam, if the karma is satyam, it means that the karma pala does take place from that ritual. Like a law. It's a law. It's a what we call ritam. It's an order. It's an order. This karma produces this result. So the karmas that the rishi saw, those are true. They do produce the result. Okay? That's how he starts this. He says, Tani Tretayam Bahuda Santatani. He says, those rituals, they are santatani. They are spread throughout Tretayam. Here, Tretayam is taken in different ways in some of the commentaries. Swamiji takes it as in the three Vedas, the Rik, Yajur, and Sama Vedas. In the three Vedas, all of these rituals, they are spread throughout the three Vedas and talked about Bahuda in many different ways. In other words, you will find many, many different rituals throughout the three Vedas. Many different types of rituals. They're spread throughout the Vedas. And these rituals that you find there, which have been revealed which have been seen by the kavis, have been seen by the rishis, these many and varied karmas, they are true. Then he says, Tani acharata niyatam satyakamaha. Says, hey satyakamaha. Book of the plural. Those of you who desire the satyam now is the result of those rituals, right? So kama means desirous. So those of you who are desiring those karmapalas, those which are invariably produced by these karmas. So satyakama, that's a book of hey satyakamaha, hey you, those of you who really desire these particular results that are satyam, they will come from the karma, okay, from the during the karma. Acharata, may you perform the ritual. May you perform those tani acharata niyatam regularly. Niyatam means in regularly, as they are enjoined upon you to be performed. Like, for instance, the Agnihotra, which is the main one they're going to be talking about here. When a person is married, they go into the grihastha ashram. This Agnihotra is supposed to be performed in the morning and in the evening, twice a day. And then on top of that, there are some other rituals. I'll talk about that. But these two, if you're married, so the husband and spouse, and also if you have a child, there's some stipulations here. But if you meet all of these stipulations, you're married and I believe you have a child and your hair is still dark. You know, Swamiji talks about doing this. Right? Then you are enjoined to do these Agnihotras and you get some punya from them. And on top of these the Agnihotra ritual, there are other rituals to be done that will bring more punya so that you can gain better lokas, better births. And then there are different kinds of rituals also for fulfilling particular desires. So here, just look at how it starts so strong. If you desire these karmapalas, then may you do acharita, may you do them niyatam regularly, right? According to following the proper order regularly. Then, eshaha eva pantaha. Pantaha is from pati. It's nominative singular, pantaha. So eshaha pantaha. This path, vaha, for you. It's in the plural, but it's respect, vaha, for you. This is the path for you. Eshaha vaha pantaha sukritasya, for you who have done good work. Okay? Sukrita, for the karma, for the sukrita are the positive karmas, the good karmas, sukrita, for the good karmas that you have done, right? Loke. So it goes like this. Esha pantaha, this is the path, loke, to this world. Now loka, there are many, many different lokas. Loke is just in the locative singular. So literally says, this is the path to this world for your good karma. In other words, this is the path to the karmapala, the fruit of the action, for the sukrita, the good karma that you have done. This is how you will get there. Right? So if you desire this, then if you're a desirer of these results of karma, then do these rituals, niyatam, or in an orderly way, regularly, right? And if you do that, then this path will take you there, to that loka, to those results of actions, to those results of sukrita, of punya, of the good actions. Krita means that which is done, sukrita, that which is done well. Right? So that which is done well, that which is done properly. So do that. Okay. So then he says, Yada, so repeat after me. Yada le layate hyarchihi. Yada le layate hyarchihi. Samidde havyavahane. Samidde havyavahane. Tarajabhagavantarena. Tarajabhagavantarena ahutif pratipadayet, ahutif pratipadayet. So now he tells how to do it. He's talking now about this particular Agnihotra ritual. He says, when yada le layate hyarachihi. Arachihi means a flame. Yada means when. So yada le layate hi arachihi. Samidde havyavahane tet ajabagau antarena ahutihi pratipadiye. So he says, yada lelayate hi archihi. When the archihi, when the flame is lelayate, lelayate means the flame is trembling. It's burning and it's flickering. It's got some energy, right? It's moving and trembling. So the flame is going well. So when the flame is going well, simidde havyavahane. Havyavahane is a neat word. It's a word for fire. It means the one that carries the offering. Havya is what's actually going to be offered in the fire. It's like the ghee that's going to be offered in the fire. That's the havya. Vahana is the one who takes it. So the fire is the one who takes the offering up into the heavens, right? The subtle aspect of the offering, the offering is burnt by the fire, but then the subtle aspect of Agni, right, takes the subtle aspect of the offering up to the heavens, okay, to the gods, delivers it to the gods. So Havyavahane is a name for Agni, right? The one who delivers, the one who carries the offering. So when Agni, the one who carries the offering, Samidde, is burning well, mean is well fueled. Samidda means to have a lot of fuel. You know, there's been a lot, all of the fuel has been given and fed into the Agni. So the Agni is really burning well. So when Agni has been well fueled and the flames are all shooting up, okay, he says, Tada, then, Ajabagau Antarena. Antarena, into the middle of the Ajabagau. Now, this is another thing. These rituals are really, can become extremely complex. Ajabagya means a side of the flame, a side of the fire, where the offering is to be made. If it's made on one side, the offering is going straight to Agni. If it's made on another side, the offering is going to Soma. But here, you want to put them right in the middle. So here's some flames on this side. Here's some flames on this side. Where's the offering going to go? If this, and in this case, for the Agnihotra, the offering will go in the middle. Now, in other rituals, as the one who's performing the ritual will be chanting, you'll see that the offering will be put over here. It'll be put over here. That's not just random, right? It's put over here with this particular mantra. It's put over here with this particular mantra. But now for the Agnihotra, when the fire is really blazing, this offering is to be put in the middle. Okay? So he says that Yada Ajabagau Antarena, right in the middle, Pratipadayate. One should place the offerings. So remember, this Agnihotra ritual is supposed to be done twice a day, every day. And so every day, the fire has to be made well, so that it's flaming well, and then you need to put the offerings into the middle of the flames. Okay. So Swamiji's talking, he's talked about this in various occasions. He'll talk about, you know, sometimes it's not always nice outside, and sometimes if you have to do it inside also, the room will fill with smoke, right? It's too damp out. It's too damp out, or the fuel, the fire, the wood is not dry enough, you know, and so the flame will be very smoky, and then you won't get enough of the flame won't be coming with enough force so that when you put the offering in, it will kill the flame. And then the flame will become just smoke, you know. And so your eyes will be all teary, right? And so you'll be working and working and working to get the flame. The conditions aren't right for the flame. You have to work to get the flame. Finally, you get the flame. And then by that time, you're just drooling and red. So he says this, say, these rituals are not that easy. Right? They're not that easy. And they have to be done every single day. And they have to be done properly. They have to be, as we'll see, they have to be properly. They have to be done at the right time, in the right way, with the right chants, with the right accompaniment, etc. So here he's just reminding. And remember, this is an Upanishad. We're not learning about the Karmakanda here. He's just reminding what is involved. You know, he's just starting to say, now, these rituals are true. They do produce a result. Remember what you have to do. First of all, you get the flame going well, and now put it right into the middle of the flame. Remember that it does have to go right in the middle of the flame. If it doesn't go right in the middle, it's not right. You're not following the Viddhi then. And this ritual, what will the result of it be? It'll be the smoke in your eyes. That's what the result of the drishta. You'll get the drishtapala of the ritual, but you won't get the adrishtapala. Right? So now he says, he goes on now to make this clear. So now just imagine, now he said, all right, we're doing the ritual. Okay. Then he says, yasya agnihotram, atarasham, aparanamasam, achaturmasyam, anagrayanam, atiti varjitam cha, ahutam, avaishvadevam, avidinahutam, asaptamans tasyalokan hinasti, asaptamans tasyalokan hinasti, yasya agnihotram, adarsham, apauranamasam, achaturmasyam, anagrahanam, atitivarjitam, cha, ahutam, avaishvadevam, avidinahutam, asaptaman, tasya, lokan, hinasti. Now he's listing out the problem. Yesya, for whom? Now this is for the one who does the Agnihotra, okay? The one who devotedly does the Agnihotra morning and evening like he's supposed to, and the wife supports, okay? So yesya, for him, for that person, the one who does the Agnihotra. So yesya, he does, for whom, there's the Agnihotra, okay? But it is a darshan, okay? A darshan means it's another type. If you are an adhikari, one qualified to do the Agnihotra, there's another ritual called the Adarsham, which means it's a ritual that, doing the Agnihotra, there's another ritual that then you do on the new moon day. And along with that, there's another ritual that you do on, it's called Paranamasam. That ritual also is done on the full moon day. So now, say you do the Agnihotra, which you will get, you do it properly, you'll get some punya for that. But then you should also do the ritual on the new moon day and the full moon day. If you do those, you will get more punya and get a better loka. If you don't do those and are only doing the Agnihotra, you will still get the punya from the Agnihotra, but you won't get the additional punya that you should get from doing these two rituals, which are really expected of you to do. Okay? So here, that's what the negates that. Adarsham. The means you don't do that ritual on the new, the adarsha is you don't do the darshan ritual, which is on the new moon day. And you don't do the aparanamasam, which is on the full moon day. Then you could do the Chaturmasyam. The Chaturmasyam is done every fourth month. And it's like there in a 12-month year, there's considered three seasons. Now, every fourth month, there's a particular ritual that's supposed to be done at the beginning of the fourth month. Chatur means four. Okay? So every fourth month, you do that ritual. So now, you should be doing the Agnihotra, and then the ritual on the new moon, the ritual on the full moon, and then for additional punya, to get a better world, you would do the ritual, these three rituals, once every 4 months, right? For it's a seasonal ritual. But this, say, now you don't do that, a chaturmasyam. So some lokas are being denied to you because you're not doing these, right? Because you need to do them to get the additional punya. You'll still get to a good loka and all of that. There's no papa here. It's just that the lokas that you would be getting from doing all of these rituals, you're not getting. Okay. So now, as we'll see that in a minute, then agrahyanam, anagrahyanam. The agrahyanam means twice a year there's the harvest of corn, okay? Corn and different grains. Now, as soon as the harvest comes and yields the grain, that fresh grain will be taken and made into a pinda, you know, be cooked into bowl, and then a ritual will be done offering that the first grains. That will be done twice a year. That's also an important ritual. So here, that's not done either. Anagrayanam. Okay, that na un negates. So anagrayanam. That one also is not done. Okay, so now, these are just rituals that could have been done, if you can do the Agnihotra. Up to this point, these rituals could have been done, but they weren't done. Okay, that's all right. It just means that the additional punya you're not getting because you didn't do those rituals. There's just no papa involved in it. Okay, but now we get into something more serious. Atithi varjitam cha. And the rituals, the Agnihotra, is devoid of the Atithi puja. The Atithi puja is this. An Atithi is the uninvited guest. You are expected, in the old days, you were expected to, at noon, at the midday lunch, to go out into the street, out of your house, into the street, and look around to see if there's anybody being waiting to be invited in for lunch. That's called the Atithi Puja. And so always they will set a place, right? They'll set a place for somebody, a place. But that's, it's not just setting the place. You should also go out and look and see, and then invite that, because people who don't have any food, they'll be standing out there waiting for the people who do have food to come and ask them to come in as an atithi to have a meal, right? And that's your duty to do that. And so say you're doing the Agnihotra twice a day and all of this, but you don't do the Atithi Puja. That's called Atithi Varjitam. It's devoid of the Atithi. You're not doing this. That's a papa to not do that. That's not good. And then he says, also, the next one, Ahutam. And not only then, so you don't do that, then Ahutam. You don't do it every day. Hutam means the offering is done. Ahutam, it's not done. That means sometimes it's done, sometimes it's not done. No. It has to be done every day. You can't just say, oh, I don't think so today, I don't feel like it, because you're lazy or something. No. That's not okay. If something happens, there's some event happens, something happens that takes you away, makes you unable to do it, then you can have a prize jitta karma. You can do a prize chitta karma that will negate the ill effects of having not done it and neutralize it. But prize chitta doesn't take care of your laziness. So, that ahutam is not okay. Then there's the avaishvadevam. Now, that's interesting. This is an important ritual. I talk about this not with these words in the Bhagavad Gita, though they talk about it. These are the prayers to, there's 10 devatas, and I don't remember which ones they are, that receive a certain prayers and rituals before eating that blesses the food and gives gratitude for the food. It's just like even in the West, you know, that you learn to say a blessing before you eat. Well, there's certain rituals and prayers that you say before eating, you know, and to not pray and thank the gods and, you know, say a blessing before a meal is considered not right, kind of a pauper. So those rituals, that's called the doing those rituals and prayers before the meals are called Vaishvadevam. This is Avaishvadevam. It means they're not done, not good. Okay. Now, then there's another problem. Avidina hutam. You do it, you do the ritual, but you don't do it according to the rules. Like you're supposed to offer it into the middle of the flame, and you don't. You offer it to the right side. You know, or you're supposed to do it in the morning before a meal, and you don't. You just do it in the afternoon or some time that you choose. Viddhi means the rules. You know, avidina means you're not following the rules. You're doing the ritual, but not as it's been taught to you to do. So you're doing them improperly. Okay, so that's a whole list of obstacles there. Then it says, Asaptamam tasya lokan hinasti. For that person, tasya, for him, the one who does it with all of these things, Asaptamam lokan, up to the seventh world, say there's seventh worlds up, all of those are destroyed for him. Hinasti means they're all destroyed. For that person, those seven worlds are destroyed, they're not available. So it's not like somebody has come and shot the worlds down or blown the worlds up. It's that the pujas, it's that the punya, the karmas, that would allow you to partake of those higher lokas are not going to produce the result. Remember when I started? Every karma produces a result. It may only produce a drishta, a seen result, which would be the smoke in your eyes, etc. It doesn't necessarily produce a drishta, a punya, unless it's done properly. So if these rituals are not done properly, you will get the drishta of all of the effort that's involved in doing them. But the worlds that you were hoping to produce, either by just doing the Agnihotra, or by doing the full moon puja, or the new moon and the full moon puja, and then the puja for, you know, with the grains, and the puja for the seasons, and all of these, doing all of these, hoping to get all of these, different access to all of the highest lokas, you know, none of these will be available to you. Because either you didn't do those pujas, and you only did the Agnihotra ritual, and then you'll get some world, but you won't get all the highest worlds, or you did all of these, you know, and then you did them improperly, or you didn't do them every day, you know, or you didn't do the Atiti Puja, you know. So there's so many things that you could do that will just leave you out in the cold with no result at all, because of having not done them properly. Let's do one more, because this is a fast one. Oh, we'll at least read it. Kali Karali Chamano Dvavacha. Kali Karali Chamano Dvavacha. Sulohitaya Chasudum Ravarna. Sulohitaya Chasudum Ravarna. Spulingini Vishwaruchi Chadevi. Pulingini Vishwaruchi Chadevi Leila Yamana Itisepta Jehuaha Leila Yamana Itisepta Jehuaha. I'll just translate this because there's not a lot to say about it. Kali Karali Chamano Jehuacha Sulohita Yacha Sudum Ravarna Spulingini Vishwaruchi Chadevi Leila Yamana Itisepta Jehuaha.
Manojava.
Do you have Manojava?
Manojavacha. I thought you said Chano.
I said Mano Javacha, unless I tongue twisted myself. Kali, these are just names for different types of flames. Just imagine the ritual is going on and the flames are coming up. These are the names of the different kinds of flames. Kali, the Kali is like a dark or a blue flame. You know, the Karali is when the flame bursts up kind of violently. That's a type of a flame. Manojava is fast like the mind. It's when the flame appears and disappears. It just flashes in front of you. It's not that it's violent. The Karali is kind of a violent, like an explosive flame. The Manojava, Java means fast, like the mind. It means it presents itself and goes away like a thought. The Sulohita is a red, dark red flame. And the Sudumavarna, that's the flame, the color of like charcoal colored, really kind of a dark colored flame. The Spulingini is like a crystal, it's like a spatika, it's a sparkling flashes of sparklers, like a sparkling flame, sparklers. The Vishvaruchi is a multicolored flame. And Devi means it's bright. The way Swamiji translates this, he puts the Devi, this kind of the brilliant, with all of them. It's the brilliant Kali, the bright Karali. Devi is just like the fire, the essence of the fire itself. He says, all of these, Leilayamanaha, all of these flames, these different types, they're all trembling. Right? They're full of energy, they're trembling. These flames are called, that Itti, Septa Jihwaha. They're called the seven tongues. Jihwa means tongue. Septa, so there's seven of them. And so when you're looking into the fire, you know, all of these, each flame, each type of flame is called a tongue because it's going to be eating, receiving the offering. And all of these different types, these seven types of tongues are there, and you should be recognizing the different types of flames and how the flames are dividing. And when you're offering in the ghee, you're offering them into this Septa Jihwaha, to these seven flames. Okay? So, that's, I wanted to get a little farther, but we did all right. Let's stop there. The time's up. Let's just take a minute. Purnamadah, Purnamidam, Purnat, Purnamudachyate, Purnasya, Purnamadaya, Purnameva Vashishyate, Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. Or somebody who really had knows a little bit more. The soma as a devata, it's offered to on one side as to go to the devata soma.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, not as the soma juice. It doesn't mean that. Yeah, as a devata.
The significance of that was,
but I
don't know. I know
it's a big thing. There's so much involved in it, and it's not really my area of study. Yeah, but,
I thought I could get a little from you.
No. Sorry. That's about, I don't have any more.
Okay. So as a Westerner, you know, what can I pull from this? I mean,
yeah, exactly.
I mean, one thing is, it really struck me is, you know, to not pray. I mean, prayer is difficult for a Westerner because this whole God thing, you know, is so difficult. So, you know, it's hard to derive something that I can be consistent with, but even just praying. praying before a meal, you know, why do I not be consistent with that? And when you said that, you know, there's papa karma for that, I believe it. But then I don't even stick with that even. I'm in and out of prayer.
I'm not sure that's true, that there's papa karma for it. That's also debated. It's not there's a big debate on this. A non-action doesn't produce anything. A non-action, what's it going to produce? It doesn't exist to produce anything. But then there's debate around the what fills in the place of that non-action. There's debate like that. But the non-action itself doesn't produce
it. It seems like there's a finger wagging at laziness, though, here.
Right, if there's an avoidance.
Yeah, well,
if there's a knowledge of it and you're avoiding it, then it seems like that is an action.
Yeah, it gets tricky. But yeah, all of these things are deeply discussed, you know. But to get to your question, which I think is really very useful, if you go, just let yourself imagine you're back in those days and you go to the teacher to ask for, please give me knowledge, knowing that thing, knowing which everything is as well known. You're asking for atmajnanam, really. You're going to the teacher for moksha. Okay. Yeah. And so the way that this particular teacher teaches, he wants to tell, like first he told the avara vidya first. He told all about that and then brahma vidya. Now he's telling everything about the karmakanda and the adhikari for doing rituals. And then he goes, we didn't get there yet, we didn't get as far as I thought we would. In another few verses, then he starts negating all of that. And so I would say you were to look at that today. He went, you know, in his culture then, this was what was valued. The first portion of the Vedas, if I do this, I'll get that. And if I do this, I'll get that. This is the way to really fulfill all of my dreams and my highest aspirations, because it's within the Vedic culture, right? And so now he's saying, all right, this is what you have to date. And this is what you think will take you to your highest aspirations to make you the most happy. And in a few verses, he says, those are the deluded people. but before he says that they're deluded, he wants to present the platform, right? What are they deluded about? Why are they deluded? So before he calls them deluded, he wants to paint the whole picture. And what are they deluded about? Thinking that this is what will set them free. So he makes that clear too. They're not just deluded, but deluded in terms of gaining any type of lasting happiness. And so he's setting up that framework for, I'd say, one of the most famous verses in the Upanishads. He's setting up the framework for it. It's that Paricca Lokan Karma Chitan. It's the verse Swamiji chants this verse all of the time. It always comes up. And it says, Paricca Lokan Karma Chitan says, having examined all of this, you know, for the one having examined all of this, realizing the anityatvam, the non-eternality of all of these results, seek a teacher who's a Kshatriya and a Brahmanishtha. Right, so this is the most famous verse. But that verse, there's like 12 verses of build-up to that famous, famous verse. And by the time that verse comes, you know what's being negated. You know?
In this Upanishad, that verse?
Yeah, it's coming. It's number 12 in the sections. But that means the first 11 verses. Actually, like the first 7 verses kind of present the world of karma, like here's the 7 flames, and then we're going to have another verse of throwing the ghee into these flames and whatnot, and then having done it all properly, you know, the oblations themselves will lead you up to the sacred, to the rays of the sun, saying, welcome, welcome, come, this is Swargaloka, everything is beautiful.
The waves are good.
Yeah. So it really paints a picture, you know. But then having painted the picture of, you know, this is, painted the picture of you fulfilling yourself. This is what you wanted, and here it is. Yeah. Then once you've got it, looking at the reality of the nitya, the anitya, the non-eternal nature of what you have, and the kind of the descent back down into the birth and death. So what we would have to do is kind of put it into our language of what a Westerner does, you know, to make themselves complete and whole and happy, and it all completely works out, you know. And maybe we would have, what would we do, you know, you find your perfect partner, and then you have your two or three little beautiful children that are more intelligent than all the other children in the world, and then you have a beautiful home, and a job that you absolutely love, like on and on, or whatever you have to do, you know, and then finally you start growing old and, whatever, and you spoil the whole thing. Yeah.
But what about just, you know, lighting of, I mean, I'm talking about just how do you take this to a practical level for me, you know? Light a candle, let that flame, and do a prayer, you know? I know this stuff works. I hear that and I believe it, and yet
I think for us, or for a sadhu or a mumukshu, you know, it's not about having to do a particular ritual. It's about shravana, manana nididhyasana. It's about prayer.
I've always thought that, but I have this sense of guilt that I'm not doing more prayer, and I'm not doing more ritual, or, you know, I'm not more regular with chanting, or, you know, I think all that stuff helps, and it even helps in getting what I want in life, you know. I believe that, and that's what that's saying, that's what I heard.
Yeah, except for us, you don't have to do a Vedic ritual. In fact, Swamiji talks about that in one of these verses where he says, you know, in Kali Yuga, all you need to do is Harinama, chant the name of the Lord. Do japa. There's a verse that actually says that. And he quotes the verse. Now do japa.
Why is that?
When you're in a situation, you know, where there are no rituals for you to do, and also where the dharmas have broken down so that there's no job for you to do that's free from papa, you know, then how to gain the antakarana shuddhi. You don't need to do all of those rituals. You just need to chant the name of the Lord. And it goes on a little more, but that's the idea. Yeah, so it's not like, oh, gee, I don't know how to do the Agnihotra. I'm not in that culture. So does that mean that all of these things are denied to me? No. There's many other rituals and prayers and things that you can do, you know, to gain the antakarna shuddhi, to gain the karmapala. There isn't only one thing, only one way to gain those karmapalas. But they're not bothered so much about that here in this context. They're just trying to show you, say, because imagine that you're just inhaled in that Vedic society. You know, there's no other society there. You're in the Vedic society. And this is what the people do. And so he's just simply telling what's so well known, you know, like listing off these fires and all the different types of fires. Well, the student would know those. He's a Mahashala of the Shaunika. He would know those fires from daily. Everything that Angiras is saying, Shaunika knows completely. This isn't something new. He's just repeating to him what the life he's lived.
Was there at some point, I don't know where I might have heard this or read it somewhere, that there was a reaction kind of to the requirement to do all of these rituals that people started, I don't know if it was just during the yuga that it changed, and people said, you know, why are we doing all of these rituals? We have no time in the day to do anything else. If you do all of the rituals prescribed in the Vedas, yeah. I mean, it's so time-consuming that.
It's so time-consuming. That was Vedic life. Right. Yeah. Yeah, and they've all dropped off and been replaced by, like, instead of doing the whole Rudra, which takes 10 minutes to do, you just do, you know, Namaste Astu Bhagavan Vishveshwaraya, you just do that, that replaces the Rudra. You know, instead of doing this, you just do that. There's replacements that come along.
So, no, doesn't Buddhism a reaction against all these rituals?
I don't know. I mean, probably just a normal reaction. Just like the busier we get, the more reactions we have to all the things that we're expected to do. And you just shortcut and drop this and drop that because you don't have time. And society changes. Like these rituals, there are still people doing this, but they're in smaller and smaller pockets, and they're kind of living within that Vedic culture, which I think it would be kind of like the Indians in this country living in their little tribal area trying to still maintain, you know. But there's still, it's more than that. There's still more of a life than that in India. But
you know what I really got out of this with you is tonight is a certain kind of respect. I mean, when you were talking about it in descriptive ways, you know, because it's like, and I mean, I've gone through that place too, you know, where I kind of think this is kind of, you know, where this borderlines with spiritual materialism, you know, this whole, all this ritualizing, you know, where that thought arises in me as a Westerner, you know, is this, where is the ritualizing becoming like a form of spiritual materialism? You know that in the Tibetan community, for example, you see that a lot. You know, it's like the more you pray, the more prostrations you do, the more you advance spiritually, you know. And I know Chunyam Trungpa, I think it's the guy, you know, he wrote a whole book about it, you know, being a Buddhist in a Tibetan priest even, you know, like an evolved kind of lineage holder, you know. And so I'm just saying, the interesting thing is that when you were describing it, you know, I didn't really feel any judgment there, you know, from you, because you're kind of talking from within and actually just looking at it as a kind of piece of inquiry, you know, which I think is very healthy. It's a very healthy perspective. Instead of, because there's a very easy, this thought process that kind of comes in, well, what's kind of right, what's wrong, but it's not about right and wrong, it's actually about evolutionary kind of stages of human mind, so to speak, you know what I mean? So it's like, you know, you as a jnani, you might choose not to do this ritual, and then maybe you know, I don't know what that actually was, as somebody who is more focused on karma kanda, you know, is would kind of focus more on doing these rituals, and it might be very appropriate for that person, because for them, it might just not be their path in this incarnation to actually become jnani. You know, so it's like these things, these worlds are kind of coexisting. They are not they're not exclusive. They're inclusive. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm,
and that's actually a really important piece, because as a Westerner, it's so easy to kind of chop through this whole thing and see, like, just kind of find out what's right and kind of get rid of the stuff that seems obviously not functional, not pragmatic or whatever, you know, and find these reasons. But it's actually just an inquiry that goes much beyond that.
Yeah, but also to see, though we might not be able to do these type of rituals and be held by a Vedic culture, which we're certainly not held by, but still, the human beings who are samsaris, they're just regular people, samsaris, are being held by that culture, and samsaris have desires, like, I want this so I can be happy, and I want that so I can be happy. The Vedic culture allows for those desires and always keep you in relationship with Ishwara.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so you can have all your desires, you can be a samsari completely, but it gives you kind of a guidebook for dharma, you know, and for the karmapala, very much involved with Bhagavan. And so that, all of that, you can appreciate and then take that vision and bring that here in a way that works for us in the West. That's, you take the part of it that's that you can bring, that you can bring here, that you can bring to the now, which to me has to do with the recognition of Ishwara, you know, dharma and recognition of Ishwara, keeping Ishwara as totally a part of your life.
Yeah, and that's also, you know, I think rituals, I actually got quite a bit going for me, but there's nothing of these rituals on it written down anywhere, you know. But to me, they mean a lot, you know, seasonal appreciation of the seasonal changes, and
yeah,
lighting a candle and praying to the gods, and which are all expressions of my intentions and of my interconnections with the web of life, you know.
Yeah.
So how can that not be a powerful thing? But then the question is, how much is the form really pertinent, you know, or where does dealing with these realms of intention rather kind of connect to rather formless form,
yeah,
you know? And yeah, where it's not about like when and how you light the candle, that you light the candle, and that there's some kind of, that you get wired into that connection with spirit in that moment. And maybe, you know, that's kind of how it fits to me. That seems to be like the most pertinent, like the essence of the whole ritual, you know? What's,
yeah,
the,
but you may have, I mean, I have my own rituals that I do and chanting that I do because I like it.
Mm-hmm.
And you may have ones or certain things that, rituals that you do, or you may not. But you may have some that you do because you like to do them. You like to do certain chants because they focus you and bring you in or keep you connected in a subtle way. It's something that's nice for you.
Yeah. I think what I'm remembering is a little more now, when it was a description of like how the Vedanta, the school of Vedanta evolved. And I think what it was in reaction, and it sounds like it's leading up to this, ritual, where maybe people felt like if they didn't do the ritual, they weren't going to get something. So in that sense, like this materialism, I think that's what you're saying. But
well,
with Vedanta, they said, well, you don't need the rituals. The Brahman is there.
That's right. But it's a little different than that, Paul, because it's not as though Vedanta is a reaction to the rituals. It's that if you look at the rituals to stand for any action that you do so that you can get a result to make you happy. Like if I could just have this new car, I earn the money to get the car so that I can be happy, or a girlfriend, etc., etc., right? Every human being thinks, I need this to be happy. You know? And at some point they realize, no, that doesn't work. I'll get a little moment of happiness from it. That's when you become an adhikari. That's when the second part of the Vedas becomes useful.
Exactly.
The first part is useful,
mm-hmm,
until you realize that it doesn't work.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Right?
But it'll give you the best. It gives you your best shot, right, for gaining relative happiness in the world. But still, it's going to be dependent upon the fulfilling, the doing of a karma to get a result, which will be limited.
And maybe reaction's not the right word, but was Vedanta there?
Yes, Vedanta, we don't accept at all that Vedanta came later. We look
okay
at the whole,
okay,
the whole Vedas as a revealed knowledge, and the Vedas is, and the Vedanta is the second part of it.
Mm-hmm.
The first part of it deals with what's going on within samsara and how to do that well. The second part is what happens when you realize that doesn't work. Then you're an adhikari. So it's two different adhikaris. Qualified student for the first part, qualified student for the second part. It's not that one came later. I wouldn't accept that.
Oh, there's an adhikari in the first section?
Yeah, the adhikari in the first is the samsari.
Oh.
I need this to be happy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so you're qualified then to do these rituals. If you do these rituals, as long as you think that your happiness is going to be out here, then you should live in this way.
Mm-hmm.
Follow this dharma. Do these karmas. Follow these various rules. Do these rituals, you know. And these rituals are available for you. to fulfill some of your desires, and these rituals are available for you that you should do on a daily basis and on a at particular times in order to keep you connected properly to the creation, so that you have a relatively happy stay here. But when you realize that no matter what you do or how good you are, everything is bound by time. Mm-hmm. And there is no security.
But you have to realize it for yourself. I mean, they don't seem to help you realize it by saying these things.
No, that's right.
They won't work.
That's right. I mean, a adhikari for the first portion of the Vedas, the samsari, if they're in the Vedic culture, they will learn the entire Veda, which includes the Upanishads. They'll chant the whole thing. And they'll know, okay, when I'm ready for that, it's there. But I don't want that now. Right now I want my new car. But that's there, and I'll go there. When I realize that, when I'm ready, I'll go. So that's a thing. They have that. They know. They're not an adhikari for it. You know, but they know there's such a thing as a guru. They know that there's such a thing as liberation and moksha and self-knowledge. And that when they're ready for that, that then they can go to their teacher.
But isn't there kind of a certain kind of dukkha or that needs to kind of manifest, it seems that way, before somebody moves into that place of an adhikari for the second phase?
Not necessarily in this life, because you could have gone through all of that dukkha or all of that, the experiences in a last life. In this life, it just comes to you very easily.
Okay.
So
you don't necessarily have the hair on fire on.
Well, you would have the hair on fire in this, not necessarily as a screaming escape from sorrow, but a real wanting to know.
A realization that now is the time for that.
Yes, yeah, I really seeing the problem clearly.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not that you've necessarily had a whole series of tragedies.
Right.
It's just at through your lifetimes, enough things have happened that need not necessarily be tragedies, but enough things have happened to make you realize there's no way to achieve a stable, lasting well-being.
Doesn't it also mean, especially the idea that you have to be so particular in doing everything correctly, doesn't that show that once you go the second path, so to say, for liberation, you also have to be very particular and very...
You don't have to be particular at all, in this sense, that there's nothing to achieve. What is there is already there. But your understanding has to be clear.
Mm-hmm.
That ignorance has to be removed.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's very particular.
Right.
You know? But it's not particular in the sense of having to do something perfectly. But you have to see clearly.
Mm-hmm.
You have to see clearly, and you have to have your doubts removed clearly.
Mm-hmm.
That's true. Here we go.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're welcome. A pleasure.